Carl Zimmer is the science columnist for the New York Times. His new book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive, where he takes readers on a journey from Mother Nature's most awe-inspiring creations to the most cutting-edge research in search of an answer. We all assume we know what life is, but the more scientists learn about the living world, the harder it is to define. Carl Zimmer is with us this morning, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Carl, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. Again, the name of the book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. What brought you to want to explore this search?
It's a question that's been on my mind for years. I've been able to write about all sorts of aspects of life and have spent lots of time with scientists who are exploring life and all its wondrous diversity. But every now and then, you know, the question comes up, well, what's tying this all together, all the jellyfish and the trees and the bacteria and everything? And it's kind of amazing that scientists don't really have a good answer to that. And, you know, to me, it sort of feels like, well, what if astronomers couldn't tell you what stars are, or chemists couldn't tell you what molecules are? I mean, it seems like an odd situation. So I sort of explored life as we know it, and then took a journey into the borderlands at the edges of life, where it really becomes hard to say where life stops and the rest of the universe begins.
You say if we can't answer that question here on Earth, how will we know when and if we discover alien life on other worlds? So, fair question. What are the challenges in getting to the true answer?
Well, you know, we have sent a probe to Mars, Perseverance, one of the latest in a number of probes, and part of its mission is to be looking for potential clues as to whether there is life on Mars or ever has been. And, you know, we can look to life here on Earth as for clues for, well, what kind of signature should we be looking for? I mean, obviously, if something walks up to Perseverance and, you know, shakes it, well, you could maybe guess that life is on Mars. But what if it takes a form that we've never encountered before? We might miss it, even if it's staring us in the face. So we might need to sort of step back from life as we know it and really think more broadly about life in general. Life, what does it mean for matter to become alive? We don't really have a clear theory on that yet.
You make this point. You've made this point just a moment ago too. But you know, there are so many definitions of what life should be, what it is, and yet there are flaws with almost all of those definitions. So do we need a new definition, or what exactly do we need?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a real quandary. I mean, you could almost call it a crisis in the sense that, like, scientists have put forward hundreds of definitions, literally hundreds, and they keep putting forward more definitions as the years go by. We're not converging towards one definition. And we have lots of arguments over whether things are alive or not. Like, so for viruses, for example, I will have, you know, a scientist in the morning email me and declare that viruses are obviously not alive, and any expert will tell me that. And then in the afternoon, I'll get another email from someone saying, well, of course viruses are alive, and every expert will tell you that. And those two things cannot be true at the same time, but here we are. And the irony is that we actually are understanding life so much better now than in the past. I mean, we're getting down to the molecular atomic details of life. But we're in a sense, we're so awash in the details that we're still having a hard time stepping back and seeing life in the big picture. And so we have these paradoxes that have been plaguing scientists for years. And you don't feel like we're closer to a resolution yet.
So when we talk about like what we're living through right now and the fact that there is a coronavirus, is that alive?
really, it depends on who you talk to. So one reason that viruses like coronavirus are so difficult is that a lot of times when people talk about life, they think of certain hallmarks of life. And so if you tick the boxes, then you must be alive. Viruses can replicate. So that's one box you can tick off. They evolve. We're dealing with the variants of the coronavirus right now. Evolution is happening right in front of our eyes. So they tick that box. They tick other boxes, but they don't eat. They don't grow. I mean, a virus has no metabolism. It's a shell with some genes inside of it. And when those genes get inside of a cell, they can take over and make the cell make new viruses. So that, you know, sort of falling short on that one requirement has led a lot of scientists to say, like, well, it's just not alive. It's not life. Whereas others say, look, I mean, there's so much a part of life that how could you somehow exclude them? And it may have to do more with our urge to create definitions. Maybe we're just using the wrong kind of philosophy to look at life around us. Maybe we need to rethink just the way we approach life itself.
What is fascinating about the book as you read this of the scientists that you talk to, and if a scientist in a lab is working on something and they seemingly create life in some way, shape, or form, the question immediately becomes, well, is what they are doing creating life? So before we get into, you know, what's that about, does that definition matter as much as what they're doing, of what they have created, regardless of whether it is, quote unquote, life or not?
Well, it's certainly, there's an amazing amount of research that I talk about in the book, specifically trying to address the origin of life and trying to understand the steps by which just raw molecules got organized into living things on our planet, maybe, you know, upwards of 4 billion years ago. There have been some really important experiments that have been carried out, but that being said, it's kind of hard for the scientists to really say, well, is this the only way that life could have originated? Is there a separate pathway? So some scientists are saying, like, well, let's not get hung up on DNA and RNA and things like that. Let's just, like, mix chemicals together and see if we get some weird, interesting things happening. Maybe those weird things can eventually perhaps develop into something that we might recognize as life, even if it's not like life as we know it. So those experiments are going on right now, and it's fascinating because it's pushing us into sort of new realms of chemistry that no one's ever been in before.
All right, give us an example, Carl, of some of the weirdest things that you saw in the research of this book.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, life, things that we would agree are alive, can be incredibly astonishing. For example, I write about slime molds, which you ever walk in the woods and you've seen some weird kind of, you know, gelatinous mass on the forest floor, you might be looking at a slime mold. It's just one giant pulsating cell that crawls around on the forest floor and feeds on bacteria. So scientists can bring it into the lab. They can dry it down. It just looks like a smudge on paper and just store it away for, you know, months. And then they can just take it out, put it in a dish and spray some water on it, give it some oatmeal to eat, and it's back in action. I mean, all these tentacles start growing out. And these things can actually, like, you know, you can put a blob of slime mold at one end of a maze in a dish, you know, and put a little oatmeal on the other end of the maze, it will solve the maze for you. It will crawl around and figure out how to get to that food. They're almost like mathematicians. It's amazing the problems they can solve. That's a hallmark of life, being able to make decisions, being able to draw in information about your surroundings and do things so that you can survive. you know, another fascinating thing that I talk about in the book is there's a line between life and death. And there are some animals that completely make a mockery of that. There are animals called tardigrades, also live in the forest or in oceans in the soil. Little animals, you can see with the microscope. Normally they're crawling around on little microscopic legs, but if they get stuck in a drought, if they get dehydrated, they don't die the way other animals would. Instead, what happens is that as the water disappears from their cells, their bodies literally turn to glass. And they can survive like this in a kind of a third state of existence between life and death for decades. And, you know, scientists have actually, like, put them on rockets and sent them out into space, and they can endure being exposed to space and then come back to Earth and be just fine because they can play around with life and death and go into these states of existence that are hard for us to even understand.
I was fascinated about midway through the book. You write about being in the Adirondacks right in our backyard here. You were in Hague on the banks of Lake George and looking for bats. So how does that fit into the equation?
Another hallmark of life is homeostasis. In other words, keeping an inner balance. The world is changing all around you, and you can manage to keep things stable inside of you. I mean, that's essential to our existence. If we can't have homeostasis, we're dead. And bats are incredible because they can keep an inner balance throughout the year. And that can be in the summer when they're flying around and they're exerting a lot of heat, producing a lot of heat. Their body temperature stays stable. But then in the winter, they will go into abandoned mines or caves and will be able to hibernate. And what they do then is they shift to a new balance. So I went to the Adirondacks to the scientists to study that hibernation to understand how do they do this? How do they survive for months eating nothing and almost drinking nothing as well? One of the ironies is that the sad ironies is that white nose syndrome, which has decimated the bat population in New York State and elsewhere, that's a disease of homeostasis because it disrupts their balance. They can't stay stable through the winter. They're forced to become active and burn up those calories. So by the time spring comes, they're in a desperate state. So that was a really wonderful experience to be able to go along with these scientists who explore these strange abandoned graphite mines to observe these marvelous creatures.
Whether it be bats or bees, birds and bees, if you will, there are concerns of what is happening to them, and a lot of the blame comes down to climate change. So how does that figure into where we are now as we look for the search for what it means to be alive and, quite frankly, what is coming and what is happening that is killing life as we know it?
So, you know, life, at least on Earth, has been, evolving and adapting for billions of years. And as species arise, they last for a certain period of time, and then they become extinct, but new species are branching off of them at the same time. Now, every now and then, there'll be a disruption to the world that is just too much for life to cope with, at least a lot of species, until you have these mass extinctions. A mass extinction can be caused, for example, by gigantic volcanic eruptions that totally transform the atmosphere. We humans are basically playing the part of a gigantic volcano. We are pumping up carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at a rate that's been rarely seen in the history of the planet, and we are already affecting life on Earth. Life is trying to adapt by shifting its ranges and so on, But it's pretty clear that in the decades to come, a lot of species are not going to be able to survive or adapt and will become extinct. That doesn't mean that life in general is going to disappear from the planet, but it does mean that many animals and plant species could disappear. The sooner that we get control over our emissions, the better it's going to be for life on Earth in general. The microbes that live at the bottom of the ocean, they're going to endure. But, I think we'd all like to live on a planet that's more than just microbes on the bottom of the ocean.
What do you hope people get out of the book in reading this story and understanding what is around them and what is happening in laboratories and in natural spots throughout the world?
I hope that people get a fresh sense of wonder about life. You know, we kind of take it for granted that it feels obvious to us. We have this intuition about life that it must be simple to understand and to define, but it really isn't. I hope that people start to think, again about like what it means to be alive and how life began on this planet and what life might look like elsewhere in the universe. This is a book about, a science that has not yet sort of really matured yet. We don't have a theory of life yet the way, medicine has the germ theory of disease or biology has the theory of evolution. Someday there will be a theory of life, but we can only imagine right now what exactly that's going to look like.
Carl Zimmer is the author of the new book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. The book is published by Dutton. Carl, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. Carl Zimmer is the author. Dutton is the publisher. We'll be back with more Roundtable right after this.